Nasato vidyate bhavo na bhavo vidyate sataha upayorapi drishtontas tvanayos tatvadarshibihi. Those who are seers of the truth have concluded that of the non-existent, the material body, there is no endurance, and of the eternal, the soul, there is no change. This they have concluded by studying the nature of both. Purport. There is no endurance of the changing body, that the body is changing every moment by the actions and reactions of the different cells is admitted by modern medical science, and thus growth and old age are taking place in the body. But the spirit soul exists permanently, remaining the same despite all changes of the body and the mind. That is the difference between matter and spirit. By nature, the body is ever changing and the soul is eternal. This conclusion is established by all classes of seers of the truth, both impersonalist and personalist. In the Vishnu Purana, it is stated that Vishnu and his abodes all have self-illuminated spiritual existence. Jyotinshi Vishnur Bhuvananani Vishnuhu. The words existent and non-existent refer only to spirit and matter. That is the version of all seers of truth. This is the beginning of the instruction by the Lord to the living entities who are bewildered by the influence of ignorance. Removal of ignorance involves the re-establishment of the eternal relationship between the worshipper and the worshippable, and the consequent understanding of the difference between the part and parcel living entities and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can understand the nature of the Supreme by thorough study of oneself, the difference between oneself and the Supreme being understood as the relationship between the part and the whole. In the Vedanta Sutras, as well as in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Supreme has been accepted as the origin of all emanations. Such emanations are experienced by superior and inferior natural sequences. The living entities belong to the superior nature, as it will be revealed in the 7th chapter. Although there is no difference between the energy and the energetic is accepted as the supreme, and the energy or nature is accepted as the subordinate. The living entities, therefore, are always subordinate to the Supreme Lord, as in the case of the master and the servant, or the teacher and the taught. Such clear knowledge is impossible to understand under the spell of ignorance, and to drive away such ignorance, the Lord teaches the Bhagavad Gita for the enlightenment of all living entities for all time. The enlightenment of all living entities for all time. Reading through this purport, I'm struck how a first-time reader with no background in Vedic philosophy, which is the position of most first-time readers of this, especially if they hadn't read any other of Srila Prabhupada's books and hadn't had association with devotees, it would appear to be very, very difficult to understand, talking about superior energies and inferior energies. But nevertheless, many people have taken Bhagavad Gita and been inspired by it to become devotees. So we can see Krishna helps, dadami buddhi yogam, even they're not engaged in devotional service, but in this lifetime, but he helps them to understand. Now here, in this is just at the beginning of Krishna's instructions to Arjuna, just in the really, his instructions begin with text 11 of this chapter, and this is text 16. And very early on, Krishna is introducing the concept of sat and asat. Sat means that which is true, that which is real, that which is eternal. Asat is just the opposite. It means that which is unreal, untrue, it can mean in the sense of lies, but also in the sense of not being substantially real or solvable or understandable, and it means temporary. this is a very important understanding. You may think, why? We can get on with our life without understanding all these things. Even in Krishna consciousness, you can chant Hare Krishna. Why not just have a class? Okay, everyone, roll up your sleeves. Let's get to work. Serve Radha Govinda. So, classes can be like that also, but following the example of Srila Prabhupada and all the previous acharyas, we also have to discuss in detail why we should serve Krishna. Otherwise, the service that we do will be difficult to sustain if various doubts come in the mind, as Maya will certainly implant in our mind or attempt to do so. Now, Krishna here is establishing that there is sat, there is that which is real, and there is that which is asat, that which is unreal or illusory. There are different kinds of unreal. That's examined by Vedic philosophers. One kind of thing that is unreal is a rabbit's horns. It doesn't exist. There's no such thing as a rabbit's horns. Other kind of unreal is the material world. It's unreal in the sense that it's illusory like a dream, but it has more... It's unreal in a different way to the rabbit's horns or the square circle. So that there is sat, there is that which is real and that which is unreal, is very important because different philosophers postulate different opinions. Materialists will say that this world is real and that's all there is. There is nothing unreal. This world is real. And they'll say there's only reality, which is that which we experience all around us. And there's no such thing as non-reality. There's no such thing as illusion, as described in the Vedic literature. And the Buddhists, among others, will say, well, there's nothing unreal as described in the Vedic literature, but there's nothing real either. There's nothing real, there's nothing unreal. You can't say that it is, and you can't say that it isn't, and you can't say that it both is and it isn't, and you can't say that it neither is nor it isn't. But they don't say what it is or is not or isn't it or whatever. They get caught in verbiage which it's impossible to conceive of. Of course, our philosophy is also achinta, which means there's impossible to conceive of totally, but there are limits to what we can conceive of. and then we can't conceive of anything without help from Krishna. So some will say that the only reality is this world. Some will say that there's no reality and there's no non-reality either. Or some Buddhists will say, well, there's only non-reality. And the Mayavadis will say that, well, there's only reality. The illusion doesn't exist. There's only Brahman. And the illusion doesn't have any existence whatsoever. So Krishna immediately establishes that there is reality and there is non-reality, specifically in the context of the soul, which is spiritual, and the body, which is material. In this context, Krishna establishes this vital point. And in this rudimentary, introductory philosophical understanding, we can understand that the soul is real, it's eternal, and the body is temporary. At this point, Krishna is making in various ways in this series of verses here. Verse which is very well known among Srila Prabhupada's followers, just came shortly before this, Dehinosmin yata dehe komarang yovanang jara tata dehantara praptia dhiras tatrana muhyati. The body undergoes various changes. The final change is called death. But there is also the owner of the body. So seeing all this, someone who is sober does not become bewildered. He doesn't become bewildered because, Krishna explains here in this verse, that he understands that the body and the owner of the body are anyway different. The body is sure to die, as Krishna will say, coming up. The body is sure to die. Jatasya hi dhruvo mrityur, dhruvang janma mrityasya cha. Those who are born are sure to die, and those who have died are sure to be born again. A very simple introduction to basic spiritual knowledge. And therefore, Krishna is advising Arjuna, you tolerate, don't become disturbed by the temporality of everything in this world, understanding the eternality beyond it. So this point of temporality, one should tolerate, Krishna says, just before this. Matra sparshas tu kauntaya shitoshna sukha dukha daha agama payano nityas tangs to tikshasva bharata. Krishna gives the examples. That summer, the heat of summer, which is never experienced in this country as it is in India, and the cold of winter, they come and go, come and go, come and go. Similarly, happiness in this material world and distress, they come and go, come and go. Therefore, one should tolerate distress, knowing that, well, anyway, it'll go after some time. And one should tolerate, so to speak, happiness also, knowing that it's not permanent. If one's in a happy position, or one's feeling very healthy, and people are behaving nicely with one, one has no shortage of funds for one's basic needs, such a person in the modern age could be considered very happy. There aren't so many people who have all these things going on around them or in relation to them all at the same time. But we should know that this is also temporary, so don't become attached to that. So a first lesson in applied spiritual knowledge is understanding that everything is temporary, and to contemplate this. Srila Prabhupada would sometimes quote, I'm not sure of the source, maybe it's Chanakya, it's in that genre, Tyaja durjana sangsargam bhaja sadhu samagamam kuru punya mahoratra smaran nityam anityatam anityatvam. So there are four items of advice here. One is to give up the association of wicked persons and to worship all the saintly people, to perform pious activities day and night, and to always smara nityam anityatam, to always remember that everything in this world is temporary. So this is a powerful meditation to understand that everything here is impermanent, all things must pass. Where's that from, that saying? All things must pass? George Harrison. Actually, it's from the Bible, but better known in the modern age via George Harrison. And of course, Krishna says it in the Bhagavad Gita, and it's an observable reality, or not everything observable, because we don't see, for instance, this island sinking into the loch, although this island at some time will cease to be an island, or it will, the matter which constitutes this island, or the form of matter which constitutes this island will not be like this forever. So we don't see that everything is impermanent, but we can deduce or understand, or we can hear from Shastra, we can understand everything. Well, there are some people who say that actually the material world is eternal. So just try and enjoy it. Some Vedavadarata, persons who are attached to the words of the Vedas which recommend going to the heavenly planets. And you may say, well, you come back again. You say, yeah, okay, we come back again, we'll do more sacrifices and we'll go up again. So we spend a short time on earth, do some pious activities, go up and enjoy for a long time, come back again and just keep on going. Some people postulate like that. But the temporality of this world, it's to meditate upon this. Actually, all spiritually minded people meditate on this, and even people who are not spiritually minded. It helps really to put everything in a philosophical perspective. Even this, some spacecraft, quite a few years ago now, went to the furthest reaches of our tiny little solar system and took a photo from space and showed, and in that photo, which was sent back, so we're told, we don't really know what the scientists are doing, but there was a photo of all these stars and glowing objects in space, and then in the published version, or in some published versions of this photograph, an arrow was superimposed pointing at one little glowing object among thousands of others, and that was the Earth. So that helps to put into perspective how insignificant is our position in space. And if we consider our position in time, here we are living out our life with all our hopes and dreams and ambitions and fears and prejudices, and we're here for a short time, very short time, just a flick of a switch time. Even if we live, so we may think someone is living a very long life if they live to be 130 years, it's absolutely insignificant if we consider the grand march of time. How long is time? Millions, trillions, zillions, and it goes on and on and on. So it's good to remember our own temporality, that it's just like an instant. Our whole life is just like a moment. It just goes. We have no power to hold on to it. We have no power to stay in this body or stay. Of course, we will remain alive. That's the message of this verse. But in the particular situation that we're in now, which we so strongly identify with, well, there's a message: don't identify with it, because it's not us and it won't last. So don't identify with it. One thing to consider is labdhva sudurlabham idam bahu sambhavante manusham manusham artadama nityam api hadhira turnam yatetana patedanumritya yavan nishresaya vishayakalu sarvatasyat. One thing to consider is that even though this life is certainly flickering, kamala dala jala jibana talamala, like a drop of water on a lotus leaf, it's not going to stay there very long. If you've seen a lotus leaf, the drop of water doesn't really sit there. It's just, it's almost like a ball. It's ready to fall off. It won't last long, but it is very valuable, human life, because this human life is the opportunity to get free from the repetition of birth and death. Is very rarely attained. Now we've got it, so take advantage of it. Go back to Godhead. Don't waste our time in sense gratification, which is available in every species of life. So considering like that, we should think, I don't have much time, I have to utilize it to serve Krishna and get out of this world of taking one body, then another body, punarapi jananam, punarapi maranam, punarapi janani, jatthare shayanam, again and again, getting born, again and again, dying, again and again, lying down in the womb of a mother. You can get out of this by worshipping Krishna. We should take advantage, but it's momentary. We may calculate, okay, now I'm so old and I probably have so many years left, but there's no guarantee. So this contemplation of impermanence as an incentive for taking spiritual life very seriously, or as an antidote to attachment to this life, this is something that Buddhists, they very strongly stress. I remember going to a Buddhist monastery in Thailand. These were like born-again Buddhists, not the regular take-it-easy, smoke cigarettes Buddhists, but really hardcore Buddhists. Santi Asok is the name. So I went to one of their monasteries, and then as you come in, they have an exhibit. You smell it before you see it. It's that of a dead woman with the skin intact. It's all dried up and the skin is clinging to the skeleton. And next to that is a picture of a very pretty young Thai woman. So the message is there. The pretty woman ends up like that. And you will also end up like that. That's the literally graphic message. So they emphasize this impermanence. Of course, that's true. And it is an overwhelming fact of this material world which inspired the Shakya Singh to leave his kingdom and his beautiful wife and family and go out and search for self-realization. He eventually became the Buddha. The contemplation of impermanence was the major factor in his quest for self-realization, or in Buddhist terms, non-self-realization, because they don't believe in any self. Well, that's another topic. What's impermanent? Nothing. They contemplate impermanence, although there's nothing really to be impermanent. It's a very strange philosophy, and I didn't understand it, so don't ask me to explain it. I don't think they understood it either, because it doesn't make any sense. But therefore they come up with things, well, in Zen Buddhism, like the sound of one hand clapping. And that's supposed to be something very profound. Although, if you look at it from a different perspective, it's simply nonsense. And I suppose by such a koan, as it's called, they want to awaken in the mind of the aspirant for non-self-realization, or realization of the non-self, or whatever they call it, that, well, everything is nonsense. Maybe, I don't know. I didn't get into it too deeply. So they emphasize very much the impermanence of this world. Unfortunately for them, they have no knowledge of the bliss of the permanent reality, who is Krishna, and of our relationship with him. Nevertheless, that contemplation of impermanence should give a sense of detachment from the world. And we find that in Srimad Bhagavatam also, for instance, in the song, well, in many places, in the song of the Avanti Brahmana, the Aila Gita, as it's known, how one very deeply attached merchant lost everything that he had, and became detached from this world and attached to Krishna. There are others also, Yayati, Puruvara, who exhibited a deep attachment to a particular woman, and by the mercy of Krishna, they eventually became detached from that and became fully Krishna conscious. So detachment based on understanding that everything, well, detachment is not only based on understanding that everything here is impermanent, but that is a major factor in it. Because even if we think that I will enjoy this world, then we should consider, well, we can't. Krishna states in Bhagavad Gita, the two principal features of this world, dukhalayam ashashvatam, this world is full of misery. But if you think, well, I'm happy, I'm very happy in my situation, but then ashashvatam, nothing will remain, all things must pass. So the very happiness that we feel later becomes the cause of much greater distress when we are no longer able to enjoy that situation. We're taken out of that situation, or the situation collapses all around us, just as we can imagine. A few years ago in Syria, there must have been many people who are leading their lives in a more or less day-to-day manner, getting up, going to work, sending their kids off to school, and now the whole country is a total chaos. The whole situation has become turned upside down, and there's just there's no security. Ashantasya kutasukam. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that if someone has not got peace, then how can they have happiness? So in a country in which there's no peace, there cannot be happiness. So, contemplation of the impermanent. A common example is given of clouds in the sky. They're huge. They're so big that they block the direct sunlight. But they last. They look very impressive. But they may be gone in just a few seconds. That's very common. Just here in Ireland, that your clouds completely covering the sky, and then 5 minutes later there may be no clouds at all and the sun is shining. So everything we can understand in this material world, whatever may seem to be big and great, and no one knows. I think it was the other day in Dublin, who is that? You told me you were chanting chant and be happy. Who is that? Some book, and then... was it you I asked? No. Do people still know George Harrison and John Lennon? And the devotee, I can't remember who was that, said, well, the young people, they may have heard the name, more of John Lennon than George Harrison. But in our generation, it was, as John Lennon himself said, that... we, referring to the Beatles, are more popular than Jesus, which caused a big stir in America especially. But maybe in one sense it was true. Of course, people in China had never heard of John Lennon. But it seemed like it's such a big phenomenon. The Beatles, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, so big, big, important. And now, just a short time later, hardly anyone's even heard of them. So it may seem like such a big thing. Wherever they went, there are photographers and press and screaming, girls screaming, whole stadiums full of, literally, there would be, someone sent me a video clip, and then they apologized for doing afterwards. They said, whoops, I didn't mean to send that to you, sorry. But they said, see this, and I saw it, and it was the Beatles, must be in the 1960s, in a stadium in New Jersey. And the stadium was full of young girls, all screaming. Such a big thing. Now hardly anyone knows. It's gone. There's such a big, big thing, gone. So like that. What to speak of that which seems so big and powerful? There was a time, just like in England, at one time there was great fear of a Spanish invasion. Another time there was a fear of the French. Another time there was a fear of the Germans. Now there's a fear of Africans invading. It's the first invasion since 1066. It's going on right now. So people are afraid that people are coming into our country and they're going to take it over. Become so afraid. But the issue will pass. When William the Conqueror invaded England, it must have been a great shock for the people living there, the Anglo-Saxons or whoever they were. But now who cares, because it's all merged and they're proud of being English. But at one time it was the Anglo-Saxons or whatever against the Normans. And then they all merged together and we're proud to be English. It would be amusing if it wasn't so pathetic. So everything is impermanent, and we take it to be permanent. That's another curious thing, that people, they may immigrate into one country and then they become proud of that country. I'm proud of America, even though I was born somewhere else. What does it mean to be proud of America? What does it mean, actually? What does it mean? You're proud of the soil? You're proud of the flag? What is it? They're proud of the values that are espoused in the Constitution? This sense of identity. Well, it's all impermanent. America didn't exist 400 years ago as a nation. And maybe in 400 years or 40 years or 4 years, it may not exist as a nation, or 4 days, you know. Of course, if I say that, I might get arrested in America. Going there soon, Krishna willing. So if you say that, well, within a few days, America, where the states will all split up, and you might get arrested for saying that. Because people want to, whatever form is there, they want to keep that. Even if people have suffered in their childhood, when they go back to the place of their childhood, they tend to feel some nostalgia, as if it was something. Oh, it was so wonderful. We were living in this street and in complete poverty, but it was so wonderful. Some sense of nostalgia is there. An attachment to that which is gone and won't come back. So just like the clouds, or another example, like the movements of a dancer. It's a dancer moves in like flowing form, but he moves all the time, moving. And you, what is it exactly? You can't capture what is, because it's always moving. You can't capture and say it's just like that. Of course, nowadays you can take a photo that captures 1 second of the movement. But even then, you only see it from one angle, from one perspective. So everything in this world is temporary. One should meditate especially on death. we don't feel the impermanence until it hits us as death, knowing that death is coming for sure. Whatever time remains, it's always less than it was a moment before. It's become a big thing in ISKCON now. Someone, oh, it's my birthday today. We never used to bother. Once, I remember, after the morning program in Bury Place in London, it was breakfast time just after the morning program, and I just struck me, and I said, I was serving prasadam, and I said to the temple president, oh, it's my birthday today. Because in those days, now I'm a big guru and all this kind of thing, so they make a big fuss of it. But I didn't even remember it was my birthday. And his response was, well, congratulations, how old is your bag of bones, pus, blood and stool now? Good response. When people tell me, it's my birthday, I say, it's your death day. It means you've moved 1 year closer to death. Tick, 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 tick. The clock is going on. We're moving closer to death. Whatever time we have is always less than it was a moment before. We're always closer. We don't know when death will come, but for sure we're getting closer to it at every moment. So people talk about celebrating life. But what is life in this world? It's just, you've come out of the mother's womb screaming, covered in all kinds of nasty things, and then they dress up the baby and try to make it look nice, even though the baby is continually emitting things from its mouth and its other orifices, which are not very nice. And the baby becomes older, and then no one cares to cuddle it or goo-goo-goo it anymore, and then struggles in this world and dies. And that's life. That's there are something like 60,000 biographies extant, in the, or maybe 20,000, something like this. You can find on the internet so many biographies, but you can just say, you can just summarize every one of them. Born, struggled, gone. That's it. You can say it all in, you can summarize it all in three words. Or just put it in one word, gone. Whatever they did or said or whatever mighty contributions they made to humanity, gone. As Srila Prabhupada said when he came to Paris, he said that people say that Napoleon is France and France is Napoleon, but France is here. Where's Napoleon? He's not here anymore. He's gone. His memory remains. There's some statue which the pigeons pass stool on, and they can sing songs about Napoleon and this and that, but where is that person? If you take it that the death of the body is the death or the end of the entity, total end, then he's gone. And if you take, and if you actually understand that the soul enlivens the body, well, the body's gone, that persona connected with that body is gone. The soul is somewhere else. It may be that the French people, I don't know if they celebrate Napoleon's appearance day or something like this, Vyasa Puja, something like that. They may celebrate it by eating some French chicken or something like that. It may be Napoleon. You never know. Napoleon's came back as a chicken and got eaten to celebrate his own birthday. So, to meditate on death. Actually, in Krishna consciousness, our real thing is to meditate on life, real life in the spiritual world with Krishna. We're not simply grotesque, morbid. We're concerned with the spiritual world, the world of life, where there is eternal singing and dancing and playing with Krishna. But as long as we're attached to this material world, it's also good to meditate on the nature of this world, to meditate on death, to understand that actually death is going on at every moment. The Srimad Bhagavatam analyzes there are four kinds of destruction. One of them is nitya pralayam. At every moment, everything is undergoing destruction. We can understand that at the molecular level, all the molecules are changing. Within the body, it looks stable, but actually it's deteriorating all the time. But destruction in the sense that whatever was the matrix of our bodies or of the whole world at any moment changes the next moment, and so it's gone. So destruction is always going on. And the body, although in the beginning it appears hopeful because it goes from that of a baby to a child and gets strong and healthy and a time of hope, but eventually the current turns the other way, and then the body starts to deteriorate. And as the body gets older, the deterioration rate increases. In youth, one doesn't experience this, cannot understand it. How distressful this is to materialists, who invest all their hope in the body to find the body is deteriorating. And whatever they do, they can go for facelifts and do yoga and take vitamin E pills and have rub creams into their face, and but nevertheless, the body continues to deteriorate. And no doctor can stop that. No doctor can stop death. So it's very, very distressing for them. But for someone who knows the nature, as stated here, for one who sees reality as it is, seeing the deterioration of the body is actually liberating. When they take, instead of taking shelter of the body, they take shelter of the knowledge that I'm not the body. And therefore they become free from attachment to this body. And by freedom from attachment to the body, they don't get any more bodies. So we should meditate on this, that time destroys everything. But for a transcendentalist, he understands this is not disturbed. Yeah, time deteriorates everything. If we think that, oh, my birthday. So since last year, my life has become shorter than it was. 1 year ago, my life was longer than it is now. Now it's shorter. Since yesterday, my life, since 1 month before, or since 1 day before, or even 1 moment before, my allotted span within this body has become less, and it's always becoming shorter. Even since this morning, it's become shorter. Life, seen from this perspective, is just like the tapering of a candle, which goes down and down and down and down, becomes less and less and less, goes on burning toward the end. It starts spluttering, and then it's out, gone. So that's our life and our death, and there's no way to avoid it. We may try to extend it by taking various medications or doing yoga, but we can't be free from death. No one can help us. Atma sainyesh vasatsvapi teshang pramata nidhanam. So in the Bhagavatam, this first instructions of Shukadev Goswami to Parikshit Maharaj, the deha patyakalatradishu atma sainyesh vasatsvapi teshang pramata nidhanam. What's the next line? Pashyanapina pashyati. That foolish people, they are attached to their body, to the products of the body, things related to their body in the form of family, friends, children. But they don't see that these cannot protect us. They cannot protect us. They're like, even if they're valiant soldiers ready to protect us, they cannot protect us. So foolish people, they see this. My father has died, my grandfather has died, the man next door died, but somehow it never really strikes them the enormity of the fact that they also have to die, and no one can protect them. There's also a verse of Prahlad Maharaj. How does that begin? Balasya neha sharanam pitaro nrsimha nartasya chagada mudanvati majatono tatasya tatrivid. Here. Next word I'm forgetting. Next line I'm forgetting. Tvadupekshitanam. That's the last words. He says to Nrsimhadev that the parents think that they can protect the child, and the child thinks I'm protected by the child, but actually, they can't actually protect. Or one may think I'm on a good boat in the ocean, but there's no guarantee of protection. Or one may think, I'm suffering from some disease. I'll go to, I know a very good doctor. I'll get some very good, nartasya chagadam udanvati madhya taptasya chapchri vidhir ihanja seshtas. But the conclusion, Prahlad says, that for those who have neglected you, or those who are neglected by you because they don't take shelter of you, there's no protection in this world. Money can't save us. Power, position, we may be very powerful. Some Stalin or Hitler, very powerful, apparently. But when the time comes, no one can protect us. No one can protect us from death. So we must be separated. We may be attached to family, friends, home, country, but we must know, we must be separated. Time will separate. So knowing this, one should not become attached. One should know that this attachment, it's temporary. Examples are given in the Bhagavatam. One is like in a hotel, travelers, they come together in a hotel in the evening, and they know, they may meet with each other, say, hello, how are you? Maybe take a meal together, tell a few jokes together. But they know the next morning I'm going to one destination and the other person is going to another destination. And they don't form a very deep relationship, because they know it's just temporary. Another example is given that in a river, various twigs may come together by the force of the water, the current. But in course of time, they will again separate. So that's the nature of this world. Time separates. However beautiful our body may be, however much wealth we have accumulated, however famous we are, everything in this world is impermanent. So we're going to die, that's for sure. We'll definitely die. We don't know when. It could be this very moment. One of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's first sannyasi disciple. One morning, he read the class. One morning he finished the class, closed the book. Gone. So we don't know. May happen at any time, and certainly will happen at some time. Yeah, whatever. You may be great, powerful, praised by others. It may be even a great spiritual leader. But we can't remain in that situation. There's no way of escaping. The only thing is certain is that this body will die. Everything. The body is a composite mass, and it will decompose. It comes to just like the sticks in the river. They come together, they will be separated. So similarly, various chemicals have come together to form this body, and it will go. It's the very nature of this world that everything will change. And the final change of the body is death. From boyhood to youth to old age, everything is decreasing moment to moment. Nothing is fixed in time. Everything must change. These points we can consider again and again and again. Smaran nityam anityatam. Everything, always consider how everything is temporary in this world. The prisoner is in prison. He's on death row. He knows tomorrow morning is fixed, my time for execution. We're in the same situation. Or he may be on death row, but he doesn't know exactly when, it's not fixed when he's going to be executed. Sometimes people they're on death row for years, sitting in the jail waiting for some pardon or something like that. But they know It's going to happen. So we're like that. We're all condemned to death. It's considered the worst punishment to be condemned to death. But we're all condemned to death by the nature of this world. Some people live to be over 100 years old. Some people live to be 90, 80, 70, 60, 50. Some die in their childhood. I know when I was at school, there was one boy who must have been about 14 years old. One day he heard he died in some accident. Just gone. Young man, all life ahead of him. Infant death, infant mortality is very high in some parts of the world. Some die just as they're growing in the body is growing in the womb, the mother is nourishing for 9 months, and in childbirth they die, or some die in the womb itself, some are killed in the womb itself by the mother, very common, abortion, very sinful. But the good thing to know is that the body in and of itself is not us. It has no intrinsic value of itself, in itself. If we examine even part of it, we can't find anything permanent. Nothing. The hand is the skin. In youth, the skin looks very fresh. As you get older, it becomes more and more wrinkles and looks like a bag, like a shriveled up old bag. There's nothing. Even the constituents of the body are temporary, and the composite which we call the body, that's also temporary. And everything connected with this body is also temporary. The things that we value, they actually act to our detriment by becoming attached to them. Friendship in this world is actually detrimental. Of course, if we're friends with devotees, that's spiritual. But it acts to bind us in this world and get another body. Wealth, we think, is something very good. But that attachment to that will bind us in this world. And generally, people who have wealth, they tend to misuse it and perform sinful activities. So it's actually, the wealth, we should know, is temporary, that we can't take even a penny with us. But it can actually be very harmful also. So if we understand this philosophy, then the whole way of looking at the world, that I want a long life, I want to be popular, I want to have lots of money, we understand actually all these desires, even if they're fulfilled, they act against our real self-interest, because our real self-interest is to know that everything in this world is temporary, but I am an eternal servant of Krishna. So there's so many examples. The sun we see rising every day, so powerful, rising in the sky. The sun is so impressive that gives light, and in other parts of the world so impressive and it gives so much heat. But also, even the mighty march of the sun, in May in India, in much of India, the temperature will go up to 40 Celsius or above, which is about, let's have a look, more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. And so, but then by the evening, the sun has gone down. So hot, then the sun goes down, and the temperature goes down also. So everything in this world, this attachment to this world means attachment to the pain, the discomfort, the hunger, the thirst, the disappointment, and everything else that is intrinsic in this world. We may say, well, there's also fun and love and comfort, yeah, but there's also all the bad things. So the devotee aims, the Buddhist aims simply to get free from the misery. And the devotee aims, Om Tad Vishno Paramam Padam Sada Pashyanti Suryo Ho Diviva Chakshura Tatam Tad. He aims at the spiritual world of Vishnu, where there is no birth, death, old age or disease. There's simply bliss. We can also meditate on impermanence by seeing that so many people around us have died, I will also surely die. When we hear someone has died, we may know them or not know them, of course, by the grace of the modern technology, that's the news. I mean, half the news is about people dying, right? If you see all the headlines, so many people died here, so many people died there. So we should know that I'm next. There's that, in some Latin poem, there's the line which was used as the title of a book by Ernest Hemingway, who finished his life by shooting himself in the head. He wrote a book called For Whom the Bells Toll. It's in some Latin poem. It comes up that someone, because in the village when someone dies, the bell is rung. Ding, ding, ding. That means someone's died. I think still in Ireland today, that's the tradition. In Poland also, it's a Catholic tradition, is it? The bell is rung. So, see, it's not from the Bible. It's imported from paganism. So someone asks, who is the bell ringing for? In other words, who has died? And the reply comes, don't ask. It is for you. The bell, the time will come when the... And in Ireland it used to be this... I saw once in some small town, long procession, maybe several miles long of different cars following the hearse. And that's a sign. If someone's been a very big man in Ireland, then when he dies, so many people will come and drive their car behind the hearse carrying his dead body. So he gets some respect in his death, which doesn't help him in the slightest. But people have the idea that when I die, there'll be so many dozens of cars following my hearse. And people, they make arrangements. Many people, they make arrangements. They pay the company in advance to perform their funeral so that they don't burden their children. They prepare for that in advance. They know they're going to die, but they don't know what's going to happen after that. What an amazingly shallow civilization in which people, they don't think what happens after death. Very, very shallow. They don't consider. So, as we grow older, we can look in the mirror. And for the materialists, as they become older, looking in the mirror is painful. But for a transcendentalist, they can say, oh, look, yeah, yeah, good, yeah, okay. It happens to me too. Uh-huh, just see. I was so attached to my youthful body. Now what happened to that? It's gone. Shankaracharya, one of his disciples, also composed, that comes in the Bhajagovindam prayer, that when the old woman is looking with her head downcast, looking distressed. Someone, why are you looking so distressed? You're looking down. Is looking if you're looking for something, and he says she replies that I'm distressed because I'm seeking for my youth, which is gone, but I know I'll never get it back again. Something like that. So, or it may be in some cases that someone's very strong and physically strong, and they take pleasure in protecting others, and then suddenly they get some disease and they're struck down. There's some description in Back to Godhead magazine, one of my godbrothers, Godrum Prabhu, very pleasant-natured devotee from the United States, his wife describes, he's from America, she's from Maharashtra, India. One of them wrote about the death, the long, slow death of Charlie, who was Godrum's father. And as his body deteriorated, then Godrum and his wife helped to look after the father. But it was very difficult for this father, because he'd been one of those big, strong, strapping types who They take charge. They look after the family. They work hard and bring in money, and they're protecting everyone. And when they get old and sick and they need someone to wait on them, it's very hard for them, because they've always had the role of being the protector and the maintainer of everyone. But there comes a time when they need to be looked after themselves. It's very painful for them, for their ego. Anyway, this story had a happy ending. He became Krishna conscious to some extent. That story is there in the Bhagavatam also, how in the 8th canto, the description of Gajendra, the elephant, who in his previous life was the sage Indradyumna, first of all describes how he was the king of the forest. Even the lions were afraid of him, generally the lions and the elephants. That's a common theme in Indian iconography, lions fighting with elephants, because they're both such powerful beings. But it's the lion who's the king of the jungle, and it's the lion who wins generally in a fight between a lion and an elephant. But this elephant was so powerful, Gajendra, that the lions and the Sharabhas, which is some kind of beast described in Shastra, but we don't see in this world, very powerful beasts, they were also afraid of him. And by the grace of this Gajendra, all the weak animals in the forest could live peacefully without fear from the vicious animals. He had his own family, extended family, with many wives and children, and he loved them all, and they all loved him. And they went to the lake one time, and he personally, with his trunk, he bathed them all, taking great trouble. He was very happy to exert himself to bathe all his wives and children, and he was just the king of the elephants. He was very happy in that role of being the good, noble, protecting elephant who everyone respected and looked up to and loved. And then a crocodile caught him, and he was powerless, and no one could help him, neither his, even the other big elephants who also loved him. They couldn't do anything to help him, and eventually he took shelter of Krishna, which is the right thing to do. But that situation of being so powerful, and then you become bedridden, and it's very hard for people who've been very big in this world, who've been indispensable. Without me, how can the world go on? William Pitt the Younger, I believe it was, or maybe the elder, one of the prime ministers of England, so we were taught in our history class at school, died saying, "My country, how I leave my country," because he was thinking, unless I'm here to guide my country, how will things go on? Well, Charles de Gaulle, he was also indispensable for France, and he made the intelligent observation when it was said, because he retired and left France and came to live in Ireland in his last years, and he said, when it was said that his presence in France is indispensable, he made the apt comment that the graveyards are full of indispensable men. Life goes on. We may think we're so important. Everyone's depending on me. The relatives, when someone's dying, "Oh, don't go, stay with us. How can we live without you?" But the Yamadutas come and say, "Sorry, time's up." And you have to go. Now, Srila Prabhupada, he noted there was one rich man he knew. He asked the doctor, "That give me just 4 years more. I want to do some more business and make arrangements for all my family members." And the doctor said, "Sorry, can't. With all the medical ability, if it's time for you to go, you have to go." Then the body is buried or cremated, or the Parsis in Bombay, they have big pillars open to the sky, and you climb up and put the dead body on top of the pillar for the vultures to come and eat. That's the Parsi method of disposing of dead bodies. Also, used to be common in India, but it's now forbidden by law. One way is to just throw the body in the river. That happens with poor people. They can't afford because it takes a lot of wood. It can become, you have to pay the priests to burn the body. It's quite expensive to burn bodies. Some castes, they bury the body because it's just cheaper than burning. throw the body in the river, or some sadhu, they may ask, you throw my body in the Yamuna, and then the turtles will come and eat it. I saw once, one time I went to bathe in the Ganga at Patna, and I went to, and there was some body which had been partially burned, but it seemed that it must have been burned by the government people, some unknown person. So they didn't bother to wait for it to be fully burned, just burned a little bit, and then they threw in the river. So it was partially burned and bloated up and stinking. Another time I saw in the middle of the Ganges, this was in Mayapur, I went down to take bath, and there was a body, human body I'm talking about, floating down the river, because the Ganga goes fast, and there was a crow on top of the body, gouging out the eyes. So that's your body. That's what happens, or can happen. The body may be just blasted to pieces if you happen to be in an explosion. It might. Well, what happened to the body? Well, we found a fingernail or two here or there. Otherwise, just. This is the fate of the body. So, inspiring talks here about, for materialistic people, it may be just too much to hear. But we should hear these things because we all tend to be attached to the body and attached to everything in relationship with it. But we should know that in relationship with the body, whatever we join with, you know, we join with family, friends, country, we'll be separated from. That is the nature of time. Everything is temporary in this world. So therefore we shouldn't become attached to anything in this world. Everything comes together, everything gets separated. Like in a kaleidoscope, everything is changing like that. So by understanding this, we neither become attached to anything in this world, nor do we become disturbed by anything in this world. We may think, oh, this person's just too much. But anyway, whatever. It's all temporary. Everything in this world is temporary. We become aloof from everything. Of course, in Krishna's service, we may become attached. We should become attached to Krishna's service, and we should not just tolerate. Oh, someone is insulting Radha Govinda. Anyway, what is it? No, not that attitude. That's a Mayavadi attitude, to think that you can blaspheme the Supreme Lord or His devotees. And what does it matter? Because nothing in this world is real. No, there is real and there is unreal. We should know the difference between the two. Know that everything in this world is temporary. The spiritual world is eternal. We belong in the spiritual world. This human life is some interface between the dreamlike or nightmare-like existence and reality by which we can act within this illusory situation so that we can cultivate Krishna consciousness. So take advantage of that. Utilize this time. Everything in this world is impermanent. Everything will be finished very soon. We can meditate on that. I'll finish there because time is going on. Hare Krishna. Any question about this, please? Okay, I saw that hand first.
Meditate on the variables of this world and things. I see that it's kind of That's why devotees and saintly persons are always anxious to see how the people can be made happy both materially and spiritually. It's in the chapter
of Yeah. Yeah, these children, they can someone have them play somewhere else? Okay. So, saintly people, Srila Prabhupada writes, are... Srila Prabhupada writes that saintly people... They want to see that people are spiritually benefited and materially happy also. So what does it matter whether they're materially happy or unhappy? Is that the question? More or less? Why should we bother? Why should we bother? Well, although material happiness is in one sense not real, it is experienced. And there's a sense of distress is there. This is one major point. If we're going to consider philosophy, I mean, even talking to Western philosophers or whatever, they're discussing, is this world real? Is anything meaningful? Pain is a fact. If you say, well, pain, it's just some illusion, but it's factually perceived. You may say it's not real, but it is factually perceived. So devotees don't like to see suffering. We may say, well, so many chickens are being killed every day, so many cows are being killed every day. It's all temporary, what does it matter? But devotees are concerned. In this material world, people are suffering so much. The real aim of life is to get out of this material world and go to the spiritual world. But as long as they're in this material world, we'd like to see that they're living in a relatively peaceful manner. We don't like that people are being tortured and butchered and animals are being killed. There's a definite experience of pain there. So when devotees want to see that people are living happily, that's not the most important point, but they know how society can be organized with Krishna in the center so that people have sufficient food and clothing and shelter and security. And in that position, they can chant Hare Krishna. We don't wish misfortune on others. We may sometimes actually wish misfortune if they're completely blind to self-realization. So we may wish material fortune in the sense that it can jolt them out of their complacency and make them serious to consider spiritual values. But devotees, they'd rather see that people are living happily in this world rather than suffering extreme miseries. Of course, if by those extreme miseries they come to Krishna consciousness, that's more beneficial for them. That's also a fact. That is the duty of the kings especially, to organize society in such a way that people can be materially happy as far as that word goes, because ultimately there's no material happiness, and spiritually enlightened. Just like you're a Tamil president, so you could say, well, the only really important things is that everyone chants 16 rounds and does service all day. But you also want to see that devotees are sufficiently well clothed, the building is heated, they're not getting sick. Isn't it? That's part of the duty of a Tamil president, as far as possible. To do that. Nowadays in our movement, it seems we sometimes emphasize that as the main duty, to see that the devotees have all material facilities. But if we take that as the main facility, then it becomes just some arrangement for living comfortably. So that's minimal standards of comfort should be there so that devotees can perform their service to Krishna unimpeded by material disturbances as far as possible. That's the point. Not that material comfort in and of itself is our aim and object. Inasmuch as it facilitates practice of Krishna consciousness, arrangements should be made. Otherwise, there's no meaning. Yeah, you had a question? If the family members are devotees and we become attached to them, well, it depends how we're attached to them. If we're attached to them on a mundane basis, then it's mundane. But if we're attached to them, they're devotees. Then it's spiritual. Kunti Devi says to Krishna, Sneha Pasha Memang Chindhi Jura Pandushu Vishnishu. She says that you please break the bond of attachment I have to my family members on my father's side and my husband's side, although they're all great devotees. In Chaitanya Charitamrita we see, and in the life of Narayan Das Adhikari, householder disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, we see that they treat the family members as other devotees. After his family members became initiated also by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Narayan Das Adhikari would, his principal way of relating with his family members, even his own children, was as fellow devotees. Your child becomes your god brother or god sister. Anything from ladies' side? Yes, please. Sorry, what is it? I couldn't hear. Yeah. That's what I, when I read that, I made the comment in the beginning of my talk that if you're new, it's very difficult to understand what this means. So you're asking what it means? It simply means that the spiritual energy is manifested and the material energy is manifested. The Supreme has been accepted as the origin of all emanations. Such emanations are experienced by superior and inferior natural sequences. That means there's the spirit is in the world, the spirit souls, and matter is in this world. They're both matter or nature. And they combine to make everything in this world. Yes, there was another question. Whether one should stay in old age and preach and practice Krishna consciousness or go to Mayapur, for instance, or Vrindavan and pass away there. Either alternative is good. If one's actually in Krishna consciousness and doing something significant, substantial for spreading Krishna consciousness, one can do so here also. Or one can go to Mayapur and pass away there. Both are good options. By circumstances, not everyone can even go to Mayapur and live there. So try to make the situation as Krishna conscious as we can. Srila Prabhupada himself set the example of going to Vrindavan to die, as he said in his own words. So that's something we can follow as far as possible. But if we're not able to, and we've sincerely tried to serve Krishna in this life, then surely Krishna will help us wherever we leave the world. Yeah, what's your question?
Guru Maharaj was mentioning time come.
What was that?
When time come,
When the time comes, when the time comes of death,
yeah. But what about yogis?
Yogis can extend their life, yeah, by some process. Some yogis can leave the body when they want. It's not a common thing. It's not that everyone who sits in a lotus pose gets the ability to leave their body when they want. Yeah, there's a system given by Krishna to do that. It's not for everyone. Yogi means they're trying to conquer over death. Most people are not yogis, so what's been stated, that death will come, even when we don't expect it, it may come. That's general for everyone. Yogis are some exception. Maybe some exception. Real yogis. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Hare Krishna. Thank you to all the devotees for your ongoing service in the service of Srila Prabhupada, to Sri Sri Gaurinitai, Sri Sri Radha Govinda. We don't know what Srila Prabhupada's, Krishna's plan, Govinda's plan is here. Please go on serving. Hare Krishna.